Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we revisit the Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the rise of America's secret government. We're going to share with you excerpts from a recent conversation that author David Talbot had with deep state political analyst Peter Dale Scott. Please stay with us for an hour of an expose of American power, as disturbing as it is timely. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program, we listen to clips of a recent conversation by best-selling author David Talbot, his recent book, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, The CIA and the Rise of America's Secret Government. He is in conversation with deep state political analyst Peter Dale Scott. And they recently had a conversation in San Francisco at the Mechanics Institute. This is an expose of American power as disturbing as it is timely. The Devil's Chessboard is a provocative and gripping story of the rise of the national security state. David Talbot is the author of the New York Times bestseller Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years, and the acclaimed national bestseller Season of the Witch, Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance in the City of Love. He's the founder and former editor-in-chief of Salon, and was a senior editor at Mother Jones Magazine, and the features editor at the San Francisco Examiner. He has written for The New Yorker, Rolling Stone, Time, and other major publications. Peter Dale Scott is a former Canadian diplomat and professor emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley. He is a leading political analyst and poet. His most recent books include The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy, and Dallas 63, The First Deep State Revolt Against the White House, which is available from the Forbidden Bookshelf. For a complete biography, see www.peterdalescott.net. David Talbot discusses his explosive headline-making portrait of Alan Dulles with Peter Dale Scott. We share some of these excerpts with you now.
We have two very esteemed guests here. Please welcome David and Peter for a conversation.
Well, thank you all for coming, and many, many thanks to the Mechanics Institute for arranging this. David, I want to begin by saying I've read most of your books, every book of yours. I'm just blown away, not only how thoroughly you research things, but also you're so magnificent in telling a story. And that's a huge challenge when you come to Alan Dulles over more than half a century. You had how much? 685 pages. Every page is jammed with incredible stories, and it's really a tour de force, as far as I'm concerned, your best book, and in two dimensions. First of all, the incredible amount of research that went into it. Now, these are topics I've researched all my life, and I learned a great deal for the first time and had to correct certain thoughts that I had in the past. But again, confronted with all this information, you've woven it into a very, very readable story. You have this ability to zoom in on a particular moment and make it live for us. And I'll say later how each part of the book opens out to more and more things that the reader, I encourage you, if you're as interested in the book as I am, read it with your computer nearby, and you can check some of the things you read that you don't believe. Go and check them on the internet, and you'll see that they are true.
Stranger than truth.
You made a very big boast. At the beginning of your book, you said, "What follows is an espionage adventure that is far more action-packed and momentous than any spy tale with which readers are familiar, and that is exactly right. So congratulations.
Thank you, Peter. I stood on the shoulders of others, including yourself.
Well, thank you. We could begin almost anywhere because so much of the book is extremely relevant to the situation that America finds itself in today. But I thought it would be a good idea to hear you say something about 1953. This is the first CIA violent covert operation against another country, against a democracy, actually, the destruction of the democracy and its replacement by a dictatorship. And it's, I think, relevant to today in many, many different ways, but I'd like to hear you tell us something about why is it important now?
Well, absolutely. The coup that overthrew Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran in 1953, we're still dealing with the unending ramifications from that. You know, the CIA was delighted about this great success as they saw it at the time. And according to one internal CIA document that I quote in the book, they said it was a day that should never have ended because it was such a great and unmitigated success. And of course, it is a day that has never ended, not in the sense that the CIA analyst meant, of course, but it's a day that we're still paying for over and over again, and the people of Iran, of course. You know, it drives me wild whenever we have a terror attack like Paris, when the so-called experts, and the wonderful host described me and Peter as national security expert, I don't put myself in the category of all these men, and 99% of them are men that are trotted out on television after something like Paris. I think we all have to become our own national security experts at this point if we really want to make this a viable democracy. But, you know, when they say again and again, we've heard this since Bush, I think, first said it back in right after 9/11, they hate us for our democracy. What's appalling to me, of course, is that we hated them for their democracy in the case of Iran in 1953. And that's clearly what stimulated that anti-democratic action, is when Mohammad Mossadegh and his National Front movement tried to assert sovereignty over the oil resources of that nation, first taking on, of course, the enormous power of the British oil industry, the company that later became British Petroleum. And then when they reached out to the U.S. for help, of course, the Dulles brothers got involved. The Dulles brothers had a long history of representing the oil industry, the American oil industry and the British oil industry. And they convinced a dubious, initially, President Eisenhower that Mossadegh was indeed a communist threat. He wasn't. In fact, the Communist Party of Iran was very skeptical of him because he seemed enamored of U.S. democracy. And he'd reached out in great innocence at one point, this is Mossadegh after being elected, to a recently elected Eisenhower, and implored him to live up to America's democratic ideals and intervene with the British allies and say, stop this blockade, this economic blockade that Britain had imposed on Iran after they nationalized their oil. And initially, Eisenhower was open to working in a cooperative way with the Mossadegh government.
Could I say a bit more about that?
Go ahead.
The operation against Mossadegh really began in 1951 with a plot cooked up by MI6, the British equivalent. And for so it's 3 years, 1951, 52, 53. And the core of it was a successful boycott of Iranian oil that involved not just the British oil companies, but what they called the Seven Sisters. There were five big American international oil corporations, two British, what we call now BP. It was then originally Anglo-Persian, then Anglo-Iranian, and the other one, of course, Shell. Well, it's illegal in America to have a cartel arrangement, and Truman was planning very much to go after those oil companies for precisely what they were doing to Iran. What Enron did to California in 2000, they were the Seven Sisters were doing big time to the whole world. And they just told everybody, you cannot buy Iranian oil. And a little Italian ship went in there, tried to do it, the Royal Navy. I spent so much time on this because you will read over and over and over that the CIA overthrew Mossadegh. The CIA came in the final stage, but it was the British government, the British Navy, and above all, this Seven Sisters International Oil Cartel that Truman had in his sights. He was planning to bring criminal charges against them, and they were saved by the election because the Eisenhower administration said, well, we'll give this whole problem to the State Department. That was John Foster Dulles from the oil firm, from the law company, Sullivan and Cromwell, that was representing the oil cartel in the case. So it was allowed to die. And that we have, I'd like to say, we're living today under the permanent consequences of that, that big international corporations in this matter prevailed over governments. And Truman, by the way, Churchill appealed to Truman to do what the Dulles brothers did, and Truman turned him down. And Acheson actually made a public statement. He was the Secretary of State. He made a public statement in 1951. Every country has the right to nationalize its reserves, provided they provide compensation. They worked a deal out with Saudi Arabia, a 50-50 split, and Alvaro Harriman went to Tehran to try and get everybody to agree to that. The people who wouldn't agree were the British. They said, that's our oil. And it's partly because they were a poor country, I guess. But
no, I think that's important. And of course, under Truman, you have the vestiges, at least, of the New Deal. Mm-hmm. Truman isn't exactly FDR himself, but you still have some of that, I think, ideology in place in Washington. And as I write in the book, with the election of Eisenhower, really kind of orchestrated by the Dulles brothers in many ways and the Dulles-Dewey faction mm-hmm. of the Thomas Dewey of the Republican Party, you have then the complete triumph, I think, of corporate politics in the U.S., and we're still living in that.
As you say, from the time of the election, not from when Eisenhower took power, but in November of 52 is when Alan Dulles starts plotting in the CIA for the overthrow of Mossadegh, and Eisenhower doesn't approve it until June of 1953. So you see where things are coming from. It's not that Dulles was observing the will of the White House. It's that Eisenhower in the White House observed the will of the Dulles brothers.
And the other enormous corporate stake that I think has been forgotten now that the U.S. private sector had in Iran goes back to 1950, when there was an enormous consortium of the top engineering firms in this country and construction firms that were given under the Shah an enormous contract. It was the biggest engineering contract of its day, I think $650 million, and some of the math whizzes out there can tell us what that would be in today's dollars. Quite a bit of money. And the person who engineered this huge contract and, of course, was going to get a big paycheck of his own was Alan Dulles at Sullivan and Cromwell. So this was one of the probably, if not the biggest deal that Sullivan and Cromwell had helped engineer, was one of them. And the Shah came to New York right after that. This is before Eisenhower now, and was feted by Dulles and his friends at the Council on Foreign Relations. They thought they had, you know, locked up Iran. The major corporate forces, including the oil industry and engineering firms. So when suddenly this nationalist movement emerges under this popular hero, Mossadegh, it was a huge affront to these people. You know, the other people I want to call out here, speaking of sort of the corporate takeover of Iran in those years, is the American media, starting with the New York Times and the Washington Post. They were a big part of the kind of paving the way and giving a rationale for why this coup had to happen. It was covered, if you go back and look at the New York Times, in the most appalling way, as not a overthrow of democracy, but as the overthrow of a madman, the overthrow of a communist sympathizer, the overthrow of someone who was putting the country at risk rather than had the support of his people, clear support, overwhelming support. And so the rhetoric of the New York Times, the rhetoric of the Washington Post, is that this was a heroic action. And again you see this throughout the Dulles era, where the New York Times, the Washington Post, Newsweek, Time, of course the Luce Empire under Henry Luce, these people were all very socially close and politically close to Alan Dulles and his crowd. And literally they followed the CIA line on these coups from one place to the next, whether it was Iran, Guatemala, the Congo. Even today, I mean, it still continues to, and I'll shut up and let Peter ask the next question, but it still irritates me today to see the way the New York Times is covering Jeremy Corbyn's efforts as the leader of the British Labour Party to actually have a democratic debate about whether the UK, Britain, should be bombing, joining in this permanent war that's going on in the Middle East, and now initiate a new wave of bombing in Syria. And so the way he's described in the New York Times a day or so ago is, oh, he's dividing his party, he's reckless, he's inexperienced, even though he's a man of, I think, a little older than myself, maybe a little younger than Peter. And again, sort of, you know, giving the sense that he's an outlier politically. So this is the kind of way that you see the New York Times cover these administrations, these leaders, whenever U.S. interests are in conflict with them.
Yeah, and we should move on, but there's and a couple of other things I'd like to point out. Kermit Roosevelt, the grandson of Theodore, went to Iran to be on the ground. Alan Dulles went to Switzerland to persuade the Shah to go back. He was frightened to go back to the country. Kermit Roosevelt had this brilliant idea, mobilize the mullahs. They politicized the religious mullahs in the countryside and used them as resources. Now, is this ever a case of the irony of history? That was creating a problem we've had to live with ever since.
Well, a game plan that we used more than once in the Middle East, I think.
Right. For decades, the CIA was using the Muslim Brotherhood as an asset.
Afghanistan, the Taliban, and Al-Qaeda.
Iraq, all over the place, and now the fruit is coming home. Finally, this of course, everyone in this room, I'm sure, knows what a disaster it was for the history of Iran, just as the Guatemalan event 1 year later, very similar, overthrow a democracy in order to preserve an American corporation this time.
United Fruit.
United Fruit, again, which Alan Dulles' bank, Schroeder, had an interest in their Anglo-Iranian. They had an interest in United Fruit. This had global consequences. It was like a precedent. This was telling all the third world countries with oil resources, don't nationalize or see what will happen to you. It redefined America's relationship to the third world in a hostile way, which is terrible in the case of Iran, but is Colombia, all these countries, Venezuela, you name it, it is a real tragedy.
Well, and again,
it didn't have to be. Truman would have done it differently.
That's right. And again, the way that Jacobo Arbenz, the democratically elected leader of Guatemala, was portrayed was as a communist. He was not. He was a nationalist leader who was trying to implement land reform there in this terribly poor country and basically take some land that was not being used by United Fruit, this enormous agribusiness conglomerate that virtually controlled the economies of many countries in Latin America, and give it to peasants to be tilled. You see this game plan again and again. The New York Times correspondent, I believe his name was Sidney Grusin, was driven out at Dulles' insistence. He called up the New York Times editor and said, get rid of this correspondent. He seems to be, you know, too balanced. And so he's driven out, and then the drumbeat begins. You know, he's an extremist. He's getting arms from Czechoslovakia. He has to go. You know, he's a threat in our own hemisphere. And so they are overthrown. And again, it's always done cleanly, right? We hear this with drone strikes, how surgical are. There is no real, there's some collateral damage, but it's acceptable damage. The same thing with Guatemala. It was incredibly clean, the CIA and Dulles tell Eisenhower later. Only a few people died. Well, we now know, of course, that it led to one of the worst killing fields of the 20th century. And the bloodshed went on and on in that country as not only Arbenz was driven to exile, and finally, I believe, assassinated, as his family believed. It was called a suicide at the time, but he was found in a bathtub, scalded to death in Mexico City Hotel years later. But his own people were obviously, you know, the primary victims of this. And farm worker activists, union leaders, journalists, political opposition rounded up, tortured, murdered, death squads roaming the countryside. We have Mary Jo McConaughey here, who's a great journalist who's covered Central America for many, many years, bravely so. Thank you, Mary Jo, for your work. And so these are the bitter fruit, as it's become known, of the CIA legacy and Alan Dulles. And so it's, to me, again, it's just, I feel like, and Dan Ellsberg was here tonight. Dan, thank you for all your work. You know, we must feel, I mean, I'm sure you feel the way I do sometimes, that we're stuck in this nightmare that goes on and on. You know, the parallels between all these kind of international tragedies and American foreign policy, and it seems like our country never learns from it. We keep repeating these same mistakes over and over.
We're listening to a conversation between author David Talbot and Peter Dale Scott. They recently met at the Mechanics Institute in San Francisco to discuss Talbot's newest work, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. We have another excerpt from that after this brief musical break. Stay with us.
I think it's time to focus a bit more on Alan Dulles, the man, because as we just said, this was involved MI6 and all kinds of people. But I think most people know that if they know anything about Alan Dulles, they know that during World War II, he was in Bern and on his own and against instructions from the White House, negotiated a separate peace with the general in charge of the army in Italy and Western Austria at a time when Roosevelt had agreed with Churchill and Stalin for unconditional surrender. Now, you note correctly, and this is a quote from your book, that by negotiating with the SS general, Dulles was clearly violating FDR's emphatic policy of unconditional surrender. And then you go on elsewhere to write about, quote, Alan Dulles' reign of treason as America's top spy in Nazi-occupied Europe. Well, that is a pretty serious charge, and maybe you want to say a bit about it.
Well, I would go so far to say that if you look at the intelligence history of this country from World War II on, and at men like Alan Dulles, who are the legends of American intelligence, in some ways is the godfather of modern American intelligence, you see that treason is built into their very fiber. Because they say this quite openly in their various statements that I quote in the book, he and his brother John Foster Dulles, who became Secretary of State under Eisenhower, they believed that democracy was too important to be left in the hands of mere people like you and me and our elected representatives. So it was their duty, as people who knew better, who represented the most elite forces in American society, to pursue their own policies, whether or not they happened to correspond with the policies of our leaders, including the president, whoever was president at the time. And this, I began the book, you're right, Peter, talking about the Nazi era. And to me, this was one of the most flagrant examples of this, because here you have clearly, for most people, a clear-cut case of good versus evil. You know, you have the Western allies coming together to defeat this unprecedented historical evil in the Hitler regime. And yet, the Dulles brothers, and not just them, I don't want to like single them out above, their group. We're talking about people in Wall Street, people at the top level of American, the corporate world, Standard Oil, General Motors. Many of these companies, many of these executives had long-standing relations with German companies, even as they morphed into being part of the Nazi regime. Talking about IG Farben, the notorious chemical company that produced Zyklon B that was used to exterminate Jews. I'm talking about...
And the slave labor camps.
And slave labor
Auschwitz,
camps.
Yes.
The Krupp Steel conglomerate that, of course, was an instrumental part of the Nazi war machine, and a number of others. So these companies were corporate clients of the Dulles brothers. They were giving the head, Hermann Schmidt, who was head of IG Farben and later was put on trial for war crimes, was actually exchanging cheery Christmas cards with the Dulles brothers and others as he was producing Zyklon B in the early days of the war. And these relations continued seamlessly as Dulles has himself sent to Switzerland during the war. Why not London, where most of the OSS is headquartered? Because I believe Switzerland, of course, is the financial haven for the Nazi financial machine. They're using Swiss-based banks to launder their loot that they're expropriating from Europe as they conquer Europe. And Alan Dulles wants to continue to be there, so he's in position to represent these German clients and American clients and be in position, I think, to try to preserve what he feels is most viable about the German regime after the war as a bulwark against the Soviet Union.
Yeah, which, can I pick up?
Yes, go ahead.
I don't think it was a personal motive, you know, what's good for Sullivan and Cromwell. I do think that Alan Dulles, and not he alone by any means, was very worried about what would Germany be after it had been destroyed in the war, that the chances that it would go communist were very great. And added to that, you know, Roosevelt, who came out of this establishment, deep state milieu of Wall Street, had become a very bitter opponent of it, as was Truman after him. And he was quite willing to have it. He allowed his Secretary of the Treasury, Morgenthau, who was Jewish, to come up with a plan for post-war Germany, which was to eliminate German industry and turn it back into three or four small states growing potatoes. He felt that wouldn't work, and I must say, I don't think it would have worked either. But it was policy. At the Quebec conference, a sort of modified, slightly scaled back version of the Morgenthau plan was Roosevelt's policy, and Dulles was dead set on the idea that we have to act with the traditional element, not necessarily Nazis. A lot of them became Nazi, and the Nazis had become part of the fabric. Despite what some people say, I don't think he was trying to save Nazis per se. He was trying to save the German ruling class, or shall we say the German deep state, because they had a deep state there. And so this led to all kinds of dealings. And in my view, Sunrise was important for the surrender of troops in Italy, but which didn't change the war at all. It was 6 days before the total surrender.
Operation Sunrise was Alan Dulles' scheme to cut a separate peace deal with Nazi forces in Italy and to hold off the Red Army from getting into northern Italy.
If there was ever a sign that Dulles was running his own policy and not the White House policy, it was doing this thing which was dead set opposed to White House policy. But he was making connections which were very important. And let me quote from your book. Now, I'm going to jump ahead to another crucial period, which is the period of the Hiss trials and...
One comment on the Nazi period, Peter,
sure.
Before we jump there. I, you know, want to agree that I think the Morgenthau plan for post-war Germany to turn it into Idaho, just producing potatoes for the world, was not probably a realistic one. But I think the FDR policy of unconditional surrender that he worked out at Casablanca with Winston Churchill while Stalin was wrapped up with trying to defend Stalingrad, was the proper policy, and it was a very firm policy that Roosevelt kept to till the end of his life, because he knew how essential the Soviet Union was to the war effort. They were taking the brunt of the war on the Eastern Front, and he wanted to keep that alliance intact. And as soon as Stalin, who of course had a somewhat paranoid disposition, shall we say, anyway, thought that he was being stabbed in the back by his own allies, he knew that alliance was dead. So he did everything he could, including coming up with this emphatic policy of no separate deals with the Nazis, no separate deal making. We're going to stand firm as the alliance and crush this evil regime and bring its top leaders to justice. But again, Alan Dulles didn't get the memo. And so when he engages in the secret deal making in Italy, it was in direct defiance of FDR policy. And that continued then after FDR died, in defiance of Truman, as Alan Dulles continues to deal with some of the most, I think, poisonous elements of the Third Reich, rehabilitates these men who should have been put on trial at Nuremberg, and in fact, not only allows them to escape in many cases through the so-called Nazi rat lines overseas, but has several key people installed in power in West Germany, including the head of West German intelligence. And I think this is one of the most key aspects of the post-war period. A man named Reinhard Gehlen, who was head of Hitler's intelligence on the Eastern Front, again, the goriest theater of the war. And of course, his intelligence was being extracted through torture of literally hundreds of thousands of people who fell into his grip. This is a guy, obviously, he should have been put on trial at Nuremberg, and yet he is installed as the top spy master in democratic West Germany because of Alan Dulles. He's brought to this country, he's given tickets to go to the World Series game, he sees Joe DiMaggio play his last game in New York City. Imagine how the fellow New Yorkers sitting in those stands would have felt if they knew who was sitting among them that day. So, as I say in the book, I make the case that in some ways the Third Reich was not so much defeated and destroyed as it was repurposed by the United States after the war.
Yeah, there was a gap, I think, where they began seriously to denazify. And then John J. McCloy, who is a representative of the Rockefeller interests and the world that Alan Dulles represented, turned it around. And we can wait for the question period as to whether that, just how evil that was. But I do want to make the point that Alan Dulles' idea that he knows better than Roosevelt is not unique to him by any means. His brother had it. He was talking about oil cartels in 1931, and that he said that these stupid politicians think they know how to run the country and they want to do something to the oil cartels. It was clear to John Foster Dulles that the world of the oil cartels was the real government of the world and needed to be preserved. And you find these kind of quotations from people all through that particular set. Well, now I'm going to jump ahead because we're running out of time and look after the war. Alan Dulles is now back as a lawyer at Sullivan and Cromwell. And Truman has just told Donovan, no, you can't turn the OSS into a CIA. Truman did not want a CIA. And yet, not only did we get a CIA, but Alan Dulles is designing it with the Council on Foreign Relations up in New York. How did that happen?
And Truman said he didn't want a Gestapo, is the way he put it.
Right. So how was New York able to tell Truman not only that he needed a CIA, but to give him a blueprint for it?
In some ways, I think it was done without Truman's knowledge. As you know, this organization, the OPC,
right,
which was this purposely very bland title, I believe it stood for the Office of Policy Coordination, right, which of course means nothing. This was a
watch out for those bland titles.
When their first goal, of course, as part of their plan to roll back the New Deal and purge Washington of all New Deal sort of thinking, it was to get Tom Dewey elected in 1948. And we know, of course, Dewey did defeat Truman. No, he didn't. Dewey was the Dulles brothers' man. He had run once before in 44 and lost, and everyone thought he was a shoo-in in 48, that Truman was kind of this hack from Missouri, wasn't well known, that the left wing of the Democratic Party had split away under Henry Wallace. And so they thought that, you know, 48 was there for the Republicans' picking. But he does get defeated in a stunning upset. And so the Dulles brothers, and Alan in particular, have to go to Plan B at that point. He was already picking out his drapes for the CIA's office. He had helped create the CIA in 1947.
Six. Well, no, it was
signed into order. Yeah.
It was passed into law in 47,
right,
but the Dulles Committee recommendation was in 46.
Exactly.
A lawyer in Wall Street is telling the president what he should do for his...
Right. So plan B always with these people was, okay, if you don't get your way electorally and you can't just take power in, you know, kind of an out front way, is you do it behind the scenes. And so I think one of the key ways, and I know, Peter, you know a lot about this and you can fill in, is they did create this obscure, mysterious organization called the Office of Policy Coordination within the State Department under a guy named Frank Wisner, who was a longtime accomplice and colleague of Alan Dulles, a fellow Wall Street guy who had gone into the OSS like Dulles during World War II. And they were very close allies.
Can I give you... In book after book, you read the standard explanation, which, by the way, is true as far as it goes, just not the whole truth. The CIA was set up to gather intelligence, and then there were about eight words in the National Security Act that said, and such other activities as the National Security Council shall from time to time direct. Didn't say that the CIA would be independently deciding what to do. Well, almost right away, they were faced with the Italian election of 1948, and the big American corporations faced expropriation in Italy. And they went to Washington, and Secretary of Defense Forrestal, who was another Wall Street banker, part of this milieu, he said, oh, no, you bankers should handle that yourselves. And they started raising money among the bankers in New York City. And then Alan Dulles, who's only a private lawyer after all, said, no, that's wrong. The government has to do it. And Alan Dulles, who was not in the government, prevailed over Forrestal, who was. And so the CIA conducted its first covert operation. It pumped $20 million into the Italian election, and by the way...
To prevent the left and the communists
yes,
from taking
Yes, to defeat the left
power.
And to have a government of Christian Democrats. That $20 million came from captured Nazi, I would say SS, funds. I believe that's a spinoff from Operation Sunrise, but I can't prove that. I could give you a good case, but I can't prove it. But that was the first operation, and then they said, well... We need an organization to conduct these operations. Now, the CIA was created by a statute, the National Security Act, along with the Pentagon, many other things. But the Office of Policy Coordination was just an executive order. It never had any kind of review from outside at all. And what it became almost immediately was sponsoring acts of violence in Eastern Europe. They like to talk about Albania because it was so small. They sent a team of 20 into Albania, and they were all killed because they were penetrated.
Because of Reinhard Galen, partly.
There was a war going on in the Ukraine that you rarely hear about, but the war didn't end in the Ukraine in 45. And I know this because when I was a Canadian consul in Warsaw, I personally had to issue a visa to somebody who came in from the Ukraine, had never been to Canada, but because he had been in that, he was a veteran of that war, Canada had agreed with the CIA to admit those people.
But Pete, if I could just interrupt. So the big picture here is that the Dulles faction of the Republican Party fails to win the 1948 election. It goes to Truman instead. And so then this Dulles group creates, basically, because they can't formally run the CIA, which this agency they've just created in 47, so they create an alternate CIA buried within the bowels of the State Department called the OPC under a Dulles crony, Frank Wisner, and they pursue a much more aggressive policy, I believe, of sabotage and a violent policy in Eastern Europe of not containment, as George Kennan has argued for in the State Department, but rollback.
Rollback, exactly.
Rollback. So in other words, they're trying to roll back communism through various forms of violent intervention. And I don't believe that Truman even was fully aware of all these activities that were going on under the banner of the Office of Policy Coordination.
Well, the OPC got out of control, wildly out of control. There was an episode in Thailand that we don't fully understand. What I believe happened was that somebody in the CIA was investigating the drug traffic there, And somebody from OPC was involved in supporting the drug traffic there because it was supporting an army in Burma and creating a lot of wealth to create a new Chinese middle class in Southeast Asia. So an OPC officer murdered a CIA officer. This is, I believe, there certainly was a what they call a Thailand flap, and it was investigated by the CIA Inspector General. And the recommendation was, well, we have to get this OPC under control, so we'll put it in CIA, and we'll put Alan Dulles in charge of it inside the CIA. Well, what happened was the opposite. Instead of the CIA controlling OPC, OPC moved into better quarters and took over the CIA, and that's the real importance of Iran, that Iran in 1953 was the kind of operation that OPC had been doing and now was doing under an agency that was authorized by statute. And so it was very important in that respect, I believe.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. We will return after this musical break and continue sharing excerpts with this historic conversation between David Talbot and Peter Dale Scott. Stay with us.
And so, again, to go back to kind of the big picture here, we have then the genesis of this militant rogue, as Senator Frank Churchlager called the CIA, operation, even forming before Alan Dulles formally takes over the CIA after Eisenhower is elected in 52. And so he's all ready to go to hit the ground running. Basically, I think OPC then becomes the action arm of Alan Dulles' CIA during the 1950s.
It becomes what they call the Directorate of Plans, and later it got a more honest name, Directorate of Operations.
Right.
And there is a real gap, actually, between the analysts at one end of the CIA and the operatives. And you meet an analyst, you say, oh, I'm not a spook. A lot of them have blown the whistle.
But again, so every president that Dulles supposedly is serving is being subverted in one sense or another. Truman, just to flash forward then, you know, to 1963, and I'm sure we'll have some questions about the Kennedy era, writes this, how many people know about the Washington Post op-ed piece that Harry Truman wrote in December 1963, shortly after the assassination of President Kennedy? No, just
very
a couple
important.
Of people. All right.
Very important. Yeah.
Very important piece of American history. So Harry Truman, for some reason or other, we can speculate why, decides in that very fraught moment when the whole country is still in mourning over the events in Dallas to write this very explosive op-ed piece in the Washington Post, of course, the nation's capital's newspaper. And in it, he basically says that I've created a monster. I never meant to create a CIA that was as militant and aggressive and violent as the CIA has become. I wanted an organization that basically just coordinated intelligence for the White House and passed on the most important information to the White House. He did not want to create a organization that was threatening, as he said, democracies overseas, was creating all sorts of mischief in foreign countries, and most provocatively, he says, that has now become so out of control it's threatening our own democracy at home. Well, that was heavy language from a former president who had created the CIA, as I say, in this particular historical moment. Alan Dulles knew how threatening this was, because this allowed, of course, this is the way the American media works. It needs some cover to get brave. You never see the American media be brave on its own. So the former president had then gave a lot of columnists around the country working for different newspapers, you know, the sort of permission to also launch their own attacks on the CIA. And suddenly there's a wave of critical, you know, commentary in the American press about the CIA at this very fraught moment. Alan Dulles knew this couldn't stand. So he immediately starts, you know, going to sort of the Washington power elite, Clark Clifford, the, you know, major power attorney who'd served in the Truman administration, and basically say, look, talk sense to Truman. He's off the reservation here. Get him to retract this amazing provocative op-ed. That fails, of course, because Harry Truman is famously a stubborn character. So Alan Dulles gets on an airplane and flies down to Independence, Missouri, meets with Truman at the Truman Library, and again, strong arms him. In typical Dulles way, he tries to charm him at first. Mr. President, you created this great institution. Surely you feel some sense of ownership here, and so on. That doesn't work. Then he does the next best thing. He flies back home, and he can't change the truth. He can't change reality. So in great CIA, you know, style, he changes the record. He writes a letter to the general counsel of the CIA, Lawrence Houston, and says, I just came back from Missouri. I talked to Harry, and it was the most amazing thing. He had no recollection of this article he'd written. It was as if he was senile. You know, the old guy has gone off his rocker, and he wrote this thing, or someone wrote it for him, and he put his name on it. And so that goes down then within the CIA sort of official history as what happened. And in fact, years later, you still see official CIA histories basically saying, well, yeah, an aide, some young aide to Harry Truman got this, you know, bee in his bonnet and went off and attacked the CIA in this piece for the Washington Post and put the president's name on it, you know. But it was clear that Harry Truman was in his right mind. He continued to take this position, this critical position about the CIA for the rest of his life. In oral history, with the famous oral history he did with Merle Miller, in letters that he wrote to newspaper and magazine editors. So this is the way that Dulles operated.
Unless anyone thinks that Harry Truman was some kind of lone nut, let's put this in perspective. At one of Eisenhower's last meetings in the White House, he said that he had tried to reform the whole intelligence industry and totally failed. And what he was leaving for the next president was a legacy of ashes. And when Dulles went to Independence, he knew that before he was assassinated, Kennedy was saying in the White House that he was going to splinter the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds. Nixon, I'll skip Johnson, though I could talk about Johnson too, but very clearly with Nixon, it became a battle between Nixon and the then CIA, Richard Helms, who deserves, I think, more space in this story than you could fit into your book. But it was going to be Nixon or Helms, and Nixon, fearing Helms, banished him, as he thought, to Iran, and Helms in Tehran got in cahoots with the intelligence agencies of Iran, Saudi Arabia, and notably France. And the man who went was not, in the end, Helms outlasted Nixon. I definitely believe that Nixon is a casualty as a president of having challenged unsuccessfully the CIA. We don't have time for that now. But if we go on, Carter tried to challenge the CIA.
There's a theme here.
Yes, from the Bay of Pigs to the election of Reagan is a very crucial period in American history in which time after time the White House is opposing the what I call the deep state, but let's just say the CIA, And time after time, the CIA wins until you have the Reagan Revolution, and we don't have that problem anymore because
they're one and the same.
Somebody like Obama is not in a position to say, I'm going to scatter the CIA into 1,000 pieces. Presidents know they don't have that power.
So the last third of my book, as you know, Peter, deals with the crucial Kennedy era. And as you say, JFK, in my estimation, is the only president, really, during the Dulles era, who does stand up to the Dulles forces and say, I'm drawing the line here. And he does this after the Bay of Pigs, the disastrous CIA-orchestrated invasion of Cuba, which I believe, I argue in the book, was meant to fail. And the
CIA meant it to require the White House to come in with support from the Navy and the – yes, exactly.
Yes.
I agree.
And I think the CIA's own internal kind of autopsies that were done on the Bay of Pigs disaster basically say that.
They blame Kennedy for not having come in when he had said in advance he wouldn't.
I mean, the Kirkpatrick report, which was done by the Inspector General of the CIA, basically said Allen Dulles staffed this operation with C-level CIA people. It was doomed to fail from the very beginning. And I believe that was intentional because Allen Dulles, as Peter just said, wanted the invasion, which was going to end up as a debacle, to trigger an all-out U.S. military invasion. Because by then they would knew that this young president was really in a bind. Oh, my God, this is going to be a huge humiliation. I have to send in the Marines now and the Air Force to save this thing. Kennedy shocks them, this young president, by saying, no, I told you I didn't want this to be a loud invasion, as you put it, and I'm pulling the plug on it. Well, that's the beginning of this enormous rupture between the Kennedy White House and his national security state, particularly with Allen Dulles. He threatens, as Peter said, to shatter the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds. He does, as I detail in my book, have Arthur Schlesinger, his deputy in the White House, the Harvard historian who had an intelligence background. He'd served in the OSS. He begins to research the CIA and how it can be, if not splintered, how it can be broken up, how it can be put under more democratic control, and so on. And so these reforms are starting to be at least researched, if not implemented. And Dulles and his two top deputies are forced out of the CIA. But once again, Allen Dulles, as I argue in the book, doesn't get the memo. He goes home to Georgetown, and he amazingly continues to operate, even though he's been fired by the President of the United States, as if he's still Director of Central Intelligence. He continues to meet with his top deputies. He continues to formulate policy with them that undermines the Kennedy policy over and over again, as I show in the book. So again, this treasonous pattern where you have top intelligence officials openly defying the Kennedy presidency and secretly defying it after he's fired is just an amazing story.
Can I add just
yeah.
one detail to that? That's not in your book, but is in Tim Weiner's book, Legacy of Ashes. One of the people who was appalled at the CIA right after the Kennedy assassination was CIA Director John McCone, who had been put in there by Kennedy to try and get the CIA under control. Most of my life, I regarded John McCone as a complete right-winger representing the oil industry, not to be trusted. But there's a quote from McCone in this Tim Weiner book that by March of 1964, which incidentally is the month that Richard Helms perjures himself about the CIA relationship to Oswald. I don't have time to get into that here, but what's interesting, McCone said, I want to get us out of the cloak and dagger business totally. In other words, he's agreeing with Truman that the CIA should not have a operational capacity, and coming from the director of the CIA, that gives you an idea of just how much...
We might have some disagreement over that, Peter, because I think Dulles pretty much felt that McCone was carrying on his policy, was kind of a front man who really didn't know what was happening within the deepest bowels of the agency, but basically a cold warrior like him. I mean, even the Kennedy brothers, I quote this from the White House tapes, say they fed up with him by a certain point. They go, he's a real bastard. You know, Bobby and Jack are talking. Because, as Schlesinger said, he was going around all over Washington talking about the Kennedys, McCone, and criticizing their policies and so on. So I don't see him as such a great guy, but I do think he was not prepared to be a Dulles. And I do think he probably had some, if he had known what was going on, right, the full extent of the assassinations and all
According
that.
According to Tim
Weiner. He was a Catholic who had, I think, some moral
He was on that. Record that you don't assassinate people. He was talking about Jim.
Yeah,
but
I agree with that.
But one other fact is that in the afternoon of November 22nd, McCone went from the CIA to talk to Bobby about his brother has just been killed an hour earlier. It's a very momentous moment. And
he says, did your guys kill him?
Yes, exactly. We don't know the content of the McCone RFK conversation, but
But he asked the wrong guy, because McCone doesn't know about the assassination operation.
That's what I'm trying to say. We know the content because Bobby then called in his Cuban right-hand man, Harry Ruiz Williams, and said, one of your boys did it. And that must have come from McCone. And that evening, very late, on the evening of, I don't know if you know this actually, late on the evening of November 22nd, McCone learns for the first time that the CIA had been working with the mafia to assassinate Castro.
But this is really important. Okay, and we can leave it at this and then open up. So in other words, the CIA, in the oldest conspiracy theory there is, immediately the CIA is putting out through all their media assets, the word all around the world, Castro did this. Castro is behind the assassination of President Kennedy. They're still doing it to this day. Politico ran an appalling piece about a month ago by Phil Shannon, a former New York Times reporter, in which he again carried water for the CIA and said that, you know, Castro did it, which is
based on a CIA release.
Based on a CIA
which
release.
Which is, to me, a masterful piece of
We can go into why Fidel had nothing to do with it, but
this is all obstruction of justice, by the way. This
but at
is
the same time
case.
That the CIA is trying to pin this on Castro, Bobby Kennedy, the Attorney General of the United States, a man who probably knew more about the dark side of power because of his own investigative background than any other public figure at the time, and of course because it was his brother who had been murdered, had the biggest investment in getting at the truth. He's saying within an hour, hearing about what happened in Dallas, he's confronting his anti-Castro friend, Harry Ruiz Williams, who Peter just mentioned, and saying one of your guys did it. In other words, someone who's part of the CIA anti-Castro operation killed my brother.
Well, with that, I'm going to thank David Talbot and Peter Dale Scott for this incredibly inspiring and provocative evening.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they owned by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital.
That about does it for today's Project Censored show. We've been listening to excerpts of a recent conversation between author David Talbot, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government, in conversation with political analyst Peter Dale Scott. They met at the Mechanics Institute in San Francisco on December 2nd, 2015. You're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest, our engineers, Erica Bridgman. The Project Censored Show airs on 25 stations around the U.S. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time.
Created by the criminal minds, political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, hypnotized by the master thief. Combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love, we flip our brothers in our